findanastrologer.com, the best astrologer database online. Search astrologers' bios, events in your area, featured articles, book reviews, blogs, MP3 downloads, video downloads, resources, and interviews. findanastrologer.com. Illuminate your journey.
Hi, I'm Tony Howard, the founder of findanastrologer.com. In this podcast, I'll be speaking with Demetra George, who's perhaps best known for her work with the asteroids. Demetra is now celebrating the 25th anniversary of the publication of her classic book, Asteroid Goddesses, with a tour this October of related sites in Greece. But Demetra spent the last decade exploring the exciting rediscovered terrain of traditional astrology. In 2002, Demetra was introduced to some newly translated ancient texts, books that hadn't been used practically for hundreds of years. Her life and her work was profoundly changed. Demetra and I will be talking today about this new direction in her work.
So Demetra, you do traditional astrology. Can you explain how that might be different from Hellenistic or ancient astrology? I'm hearing these terms used a lot these days, just as more people are studying these forms of astrology and as we have more texts to study because they're being translated.
If I were to define traditional astrology, I would say that it is the kind of astrology that formed the astrological tradition between approximately 150 BC until the mid-1700s. And that includes the Hellenistic, the Arabic, the medieval, and the classical Renaissance. And there, many of the doctrines are fundamentally similar, although since this is a 2,000-year period, there are variants in each of these cultures, but the underlying doctrines have a continuity. And so that's why we are, some of us now, are using the word traditional astrology to see the entire spectrum as a continuous tradition.
So it's not that you're not using modern techniques, you're using modern techniques as well, it's just that you're grounded in the traditional, not separated from it.
Correct, and because it's been only in the last 15 to 20 years that we have had the original source texts of the astrological tradition available in order to be translated, and that process is taking place, that we're able to see for the first time what the astrology that we inherited was like, not only at the beginning of the process, but for the first 2,000 years of the process. And there was a gap in the tradition between the 1700s, after Copernicus discovered or put out that the sun was at the center of the solar system, and astrology went out of fashion and wasn't practiced. And then at the very end of the 1800s, it was rediscovered. But when it was rediscovered, because of that gap, they had forgotten the tradition, and they didn't have the text available and didn't know what it was. And in the light of the discovery of the psyche and psychology by Freud and then Jung, modern astrology was revisioned as a map of the psyche with a deep and rich archetypal approach. And so as a person who spent the last 40 years in astrology, and for my first 25 years as a modern mythic astrologer, I'm thrilled to know of what my tradition was like at the beginning and how that explains so many of the concepts that I've subsequently used, not knowing the origin or the reason for them, and how the traditional can provide the foundation it is for the psychological richness and depth of the modern approach. In response to your question of what exactly is traditional astrology, it can bring us to a brief survey of the history of transmission. And starting in by 2000 BC, there was a 2,000-year period of astrological-like activity going on in Mesopotamia, where the planets were being identified as the gods of the ancient Near Eastern pantheon. And by their appearances, they were giving omens to humanity of what their intentions were. And astrologer priests would observe the appearances of the planetary gods and to see what the terrestrial events corresponded, and giving this information to the king who would rule the kingdom in accordance with divine intention. And this went on for 2,000 years before this astrological way of looking at things arrived to the Greek-speaking peoples of the Mediterranean basin in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's conquests. And as this these ideas came into Egypt, when Egypt was under the rule of the Greek kings, a new conception of astrology emerged that had planets, signs, houses, aspects, time lord sequences, topical interpretations, lots and parts. And during this next 700-year period, there were hundreds and hundreds of astrological texts written in the ancient Greek language by authors from all over the countries of the Mediterranean, of Egypt and Syria and northern Africa and mainland Greece and Asia Minor, and some texts in Latin. And that this was the heyday of what we might call Hellenistic astrology. Then with the fall of the Roman Empire, on the heels of that came the loss of the Greek language, and that this astrology became forgotten for two reasons. One, because no one could read the text anymore, and secondly, because of the rise of Christianity that had outlawed astrology as a means of divination. But meanwhile, the joke that we make about astrologers is whenever the heat gets like too much in one place, they pick up their ephemerides and trek off to another host culture that's more hospitable. And back in Persia, under the rule of the Sasanian Persian king, starting in 200 CE for the next 400 years, they were very interested in translating this Hellenistic astrology into the old Persian language. And the kings used the astrology, like the Babylonian kings before them, for political expansion reasons. And then the Persians got conquered by the Arabs. And when the Arabs went into their great translation center at Jundizhapur, they discovered all this material, and the new Arabic caliphs, well, they wanted the astrology as well to use it for political purposes. So another wave of translation happened where the Persian, which had been translations of the Greek, was now turned over into Arabic and precipitated the whole golden age of Arabic thought and culture. And not only were the old texts translated, but many Arabic astrologers created new pieces. Meanwhile, the Arabs were in touch with the Indians, and that the Greek astrology had gone to India in the Hellenistic time period. The Indians had absorbed that into their own indigenous systems and added to it, and then this material floated back into Arabia. The Moors, the Arabic Moors culture, had centers in southern Spain with great libraries at Granada and Cordova, where these manuscripts were copied over and kept. And then the 12th century, when the Christians invaded the Moors, they once again discovered their libraries and they wanted their material. That not only had the Arabs preserved the astrology that the medieval Europeans had heard about, but they had no access to. But there was the work of the philosophers and the scientists, all the medical texts, and there was another great 12th century translation movement of the Arabic into vernacular Spanish, and then medieval Latin. And within 100 years, the astrology had totally spread through Europe and was then being translated into German and French, and finally it made its way into English during the time of William Lilly. So we have the medieval astrology is the reintroduction of the ancient Greek Hellenistic astrology after 800 years of being held by the Persians and then the Arabs. And then with Copernicus's discovery of the sun being the center of the solar system, the astrology that, even though the church had a very uneasy relationship with astrology in the medieval time period, couldn't altogether deny its efficacy because the Aristotelian Ptolemaic model of the universe was the cosmological worldview. But Copernicus overturned that, and with that, astrology fell into disrepute and the tradition was broken. Then at the end of the 1800s, particularly in Europe, we see the movement of spiritualism looking for the hidden causes behind the unseen real. We have the Trans-Himalayan movement where Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophists are going to India and bringing back the ancient wisdom. We have Freud discovering the notion of the psyche and the unconscious. And in this milieu, astrology then begins to re-emerge. But because there's not access to the earlier tradition, it becomes reconceptualized. The natal chart is the map of the psyche. And then as we move into the 20th century, the work of Mark Edmund Jones and Dane Rudyard with the humanistic psychological approach. But for what's important for us traditional astrologers is also at the very end of the 1800s in Europe, there is an academic movement by a group of European scholars headed by Franz Cumont of searching for all of the ancient Greek manuscripts, astrological manuscripts. And they put out a call to librarians and private collections and church monasteries and archives to go and find these manuscripts that had the astrology in them, to gather them up. And these scholars went through these manuscripts, created critical editions of the astrological texts, and put them together into 12 volumes, which is known as the CCAG, the Catalog of Greek Astrological Codices. But because they were scholars, they could read the Greek and there was no need to translate it. And it wasn't until the beginning of the 1990s that under the auspices of Project Hindsight with Robert Schmidt and Robert Hahn and Robert Zoller, that the astrological community undertook the project to translate the source texts of our tradition that astrologers, no one, but certainly astrologers, hadn't seen at this point in almost 2,000 years. So what is so exciting about this moment in history is that this is the first time in 2,000 years that we have the source texts of our tradition all together and translated into our own language, and that we're able to look at how the astrology was done at the very beginning and to understand the reasoning behind that. And so this is one of the things that is so wildly exciting time to be an astrologer. And like each of the other times when the early texts were discovered by the Persians and the Arabs and then in medieval Europe, their translation precipitated a new renaissance of astrological thought. This is also what the wave of our future is about.
So the spiritualists from the turn of the century, the astrology they were practicing was almost completely disconnected, well, at least in terms of being able to refer to, back to the original text.
This is true, and because of the discovery of the notion of first the psyche, the unconscious, and with that came the understanding of the human brain as right and left, and one is logical and one is intuitive. the spiritualism, which calls upon the intuitive right brain processing, that the way to approach the astrology in the absence of the text was by using our intuition, and which from the very beginning is a valid way of receiving divination. But I remember as a young astrologer reading a line in Mark Edmund Jones that the chart is simply a tuning fork for the intuition of the astrologer. And in my own early years of doing readings, you know, initially I would like spend, you know, 12, 15 hours preparing for a chart, and you copy out all the cookbook interpretations, and you go into a reading with your friend with piles of pieces of paper, and you start reading these paragraphs, and some of them work and some of them don't. And then one day I started talking, and it wasn't in my notes, and it sounded really good. It sounds way better than I could have come up with. And my friend's eyes lighting up, like now you're really saying something to me. And I laughed to myself, oh my goodness, has the voice of intuition finally been awakened? So there is a way that in the teaching of modern astrology, we encourage astrologers to find their own voice and to use their intuitive faculty, and that this is not an inaccurate or wrong way of doing astrology. Back from the time of Plato, he said there's two ways of divination. One is connecting directly with the mind of the deity that comes through this intuitive faculty, and the other is like knowing all the rules, which is the secondary form of divination. And I have no criticism or complaints or the power of the intuitive approach. I used it myself for 25 years and had remarkable, deep, profound work that transpired and continues to transpire using this approach to divination. But for the part of me that is an information junkie and a scholar and a perpetual student, I was so excited that with the possibility that devoting my whole life to astrology, that before I died I could actually learn the tradition and to be able to generate the interpretation not simply from the intuitive, but from the very integrative and logical and system that had been developed and passed on for 2,000 years. And that ultimately, astrology is both an art and a science. And you can know all the rules, but you can still have a totally flat, uninspired, meaningless session with a client if that divine spark isn't present. But the stronger your foundation is, the higher your intuitive spirit can fly, just as a musician who has been classically trained can then go off in improvisation, which is a completely different product that is produced than the neophyte who just starts plucking strings or blowing the horn. And so I think that this is the relationship between the traditional approach that is based more in the system itself and the intuitive approach that is based more in the direct connection with the mind of the deity and how together they form the perfect union.
Beautiful.
Okay.
So, you know, Dimitri, you're in a really unique position, having spent so much time working with, we could call it psychological astrology or just modern astrology, the astrology that was, as we said, somewhat really technically disconnected from these old Greek texts. Mm-hmm. And now having studied the Greek texts, are you struck by the pieces of the tradition that have sort of maintained, that have still come through, that are also visible in the old texts? And have you also seen any places where there's a disconnect or where there seems to be something said in the original text that we totally missed?
Yes, to both of your questions. That there continues to be a continuity. In the past, they used planet signs, houses, and aspects as the primary symbol system, and today we continue to do the same. But there are many ways in which their view of how to use the planet signs, houses, and aspects differs from how we use them now. And perhaps one of the major conceptual differences is in the modern astrology, and certainly in the way that I was taught, was that everything is good. That everything has a potentially positive interpretation. And that this is ultimately what you want to give the client so that the session is of benefit to them rather than something that discourages them or wounds them or is a bad experience. But if we look at life and we look at the certain charts of our clients, we see that some people have better lives than others do. And in fact, if we're honest with ourselves, even as modern astrologers, when we look at certain combinations and charts, there's a part of us that goes, oh no, like, what am I going to say about this? And then like we, you know, rev it up and we come up with a silver lining interpretation and don't mention the other. But notwithstanding that, sometimes it's difficult for the client who's had a hard life. They have a hard chart. They don't know what to do to fix it and make it better. They go to the astrologer who also tells them this glowing report, and they go, they're totally not living up to their potential. Even according to the astrologer, I must be a loser that I can't make this happen. When in fact there are certain configurations in the chart that make it more difficult or less likely that a person can bring about successfully certain aspects of their lives. And in any life, there are some things that work out good and other things that don't work out so well. And so it's useful as an astrologer to know exactly how to differentiate between the two. What you say to the client is another matter, but at least you as an astrologer are honest with what you are perceiving about the chart. So that the crux of the traditional astrology is this notion of planetary condition. And the idea is that based upon a planet's basic nature, its sign, its house, its aspect, its sect, some situations make it more likely to bring about its positive significations, and other conditions make it less likely that a person can activate the positive qualities of each planet. And therefore, it is helpful when you're counseling someone not to overly push them in a direction that their chart doesn't in actuality support. And there's a difference between that and telling them flat out this isn't going to happen. But if someone comes in, well, of course, the big relationship questions, like, when am I going to meet the perfect person? And by looking at the condition of the planets that rule the topic of relationship, you can see if it is a particular person wired well for forming and sustaining successful relationships, or are they wired in such a way where that isn't a strength of theirs? And you don't tell them you'll never have a relationship. They probably will have relationships that will be problematical. But you find what's strong in their chart, and you say that what this lifetime is about is developing your creativity, developing your career, nurturing a child, whatever their strong planets are. Not that relationships won't happen, but you've done relationships before. That isn't the main focus. And of being able to use this notion of planetary condition to steer them toward directions in which they can experience a sense of positive affirmation and success and good fortune and well-being, and to try and minimize the areas that are less likely to come about. And my sense is, you know, this brings us on the whole fate and free will issue, which is, of course, a very challenging thing for modern and ancient astrologers to discuss. But there are certain things that I'm confident that no matter how much I visualize and how many electional charts I do, and no matter how many affirmations I put on my refrigerator, that I'm never going to be a size 4. It is like not in my realm of possibility to be a size 4. And it's useful as an astrologer to have that sense of what is feasible, where the free will, where the openness exists, and what places are more closed to use as the background for one's counseling. So that's the way in which I try to integrate the differences between the ancient approach and the modern approach, always keeping in mind that the purpose of the astrologer-client relationship is to bring healing to the life.
So, Demetra, we were talking earlier about the film The Adjustment Bureau, and I really liked what you had to say about fate and free will and how it kind of gave us a visual representation of that open window that we might find with electional astrology. Can you share your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it occurred to me as the movie was progressing and there was a part where he had to look for the blue doors because that was the way through the fate that was otherwise set into place, that the blue doors were the gaps. And that reminded me of the ancient argument against astrology in the ancient literature between, on one hand, the astrologer saying that the astrology had a fatalistic, a deterministic quality to it in alignment with the Stoic philosophy, which was the predominant philosophical model that what our fate was predetermined by preceding causes, and it was just a matter of time before the results of those causes would come to be, and that the use of astrology was to know one's fate so that one didn't struggle needlessly to bring about something that simply wasn't going to come about and prevent lots of angst. But at the same time, one of the major forms of astrology in the ancient world was electional, which they called catharchic, and that's electing a time to initiate an event. And the critics would say, well, on one hand you're saying the astrology is fated, but on the other hand you're saying by finding the certain time you can override the fate. Come on, guys, what is it? Is it one way or the other? And the movie The Adjustment Bureau was, if you can find the blue doors, these are the cracks between the worlds. These are the cracks between the dimensions. These are the cracks between fate and free will. And that there are moments, the opportune moment, where one can slide through what is otherwise relatively closed. So that's how my mind got to thinking during the course of that movie.
It also struck me that it serves as a model for astrology, and that a lot of the folks in the film who don't know where the doors are, or who don't even know that there are people behind the doors, they're just busy about their life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's like astrology is the knowledge that there's something going on behind mm-hmm. the scenes.
Yeah. So. Right. And then when I take that question from another completely point of view, which is my life in Tibetan Buddhism, and I asked one of my teachers once, like, well, what exactly is the birth chart? And the response I got is, on one hand, the birth chart is a picture of one's karma. It's the result of your actions of the past life and shows the afflictions that you were born into and your confused, deluded, toxic state of mind, and hence the problems that you'll keep having. But simultaneously, the chart is a picture of what we might look like as an enlightened being if we could purify the toxic afflictions and accumulations. And so in that we have simultaneously, the chart is a picture of our fate as our karma, as a result of our own actions from the past. But it's also a picture of, to the extent that we become conscious of that material and purify it of what we might aspire to. But my sense is, with all traditions of transformation, that that kind of transformation from the poisons into the enlightened awareness is not as simple as wishing it to be so, or writing affirmations on your refrigerator, or casual reflection on the process, but requires a serious and sustained effort that is a method or a path that has been tread before that leads to those results. So I don't think that the chart is totally fatalistic. I don't think that the chart can be transcended. I think that grace exists. I think that transformation and free will exists. But unless someone really does something about it, the chart is probably what's going to happen to you.
Right. Well, right on time with Neptune and Pisces talking about the grounding in the spiritual tradition. But for somebody who's interested in learning more about traditional astrology, where would you recommend they start? Like, which texts? I know there are a lot of texts being translated. And where would you recommend somebody start? And also, I know that this may be a good time to tell us about the program that you're mm-hmm. creating as well.
Yeah. Well, one place to start is the AFA is having a conference in September in Phoenix on traditional astrology in honor of James Holden, who is a longtime AFA person who started translating this material in the 1950s, way before Project Hindsight and Rob Hahn and Rob Schmidt and Zoller got involved. And many of the translations we hear had been sitting in his garage for years and years, and the AFA in the last 15 years now, 10 years, is putting them, publishing them. So Holden's going to give the keynote, and it will be his Uranus return. And so the conference is all about honoring him. But the following 2 days will be overview of traditional astrology being given by Chris Brennan and Ben Dykes and myself, and we've worked together in creating an integrated program. So that's the first place that astrologers can go to. I also do private tutoring in traditional astrology, as does Chris Brennan, and Ben Dykes is developing that. One can access a lot of the tradition through all of the Lilly material that's been going on in England. And I would say that the William Lilly English traditional astrology were the inheritors of the last pieces of the tradition before it went out. And the work of Olivia Barclay in this past decade helped revive some of that. Bob Schmidt at Project Hindsight has been working on this material for a long time, and there are certain publications potentially available for them. A lot of it is out of print, and the schedule of distribution is a little shaky, but if people can get their hands on any of those, it's a great source. But what I've discovered and with myself is when I first got the translations and I opened them up, I did not know what they were saying. I had no idea of how to work with it. And it was only after I had received instruction that I was able to then pick up the text, and they made total sense. And there's a way in which some text is self-secret. So this is my focus right now, both with this book I have in preparation, which is a kind of, jokingly, we're calling it Traditional Astrology for Yourself, which is a workbook giving the basic concepts. And then I also take private students for one-on-one tutoring. So these are the resources that I'm currently making available.
Well, thanks, Demetra, for being with me today mm-hmm. and for taking the time to talk and talk about your exciting mm-hmm. new work. And I look forward to seeing what you give us next.
Findinastrologer.com. Illuminate your journey.